I almost wore pants and a sweater this morning. And then I thought, I can't give in. It's not fall yet. That's right. Oh, I sure felt that way. Let's take a moment and pray together. Jesus, thank you for your presence with us. Thank you for drawing us together. Thank you for the opportunity we have to sing, to worship. To worship with our minds, to worship with our hearts, and all of us, all of our beings. Come accept us, what we give to you this morning as we do this together. Amen. Do you ever have those times where you're doing something and the Spirit just kind of invades in and kind of brings a highlighter to something that's going on? Maybe it's a thought you're having, something you're reading, just kind of pulls itself out, is amplified, and you kind of sit on it for a bit and go, wow. It's just not a, doesn't just pass you by, it just kind of sits there. So last week, Paul was talking, and he was reading. One of his passages he read was Deuteronomy 10:18. And in that passage, there's the phrase that says this, that God, it says, God defends the fatherless and the widow and loves the foreigner. And that got me thinking about foreigners. So who is a foreigner? What do scriptures teach us about foreigners? I listen to the news some, and I see a lot in the last few years. There's been a lot of talk and a lot of news written about foreigners and immigration. And Brandon, last statistics, Brandon is actually 20% new immigrant, according to the last census. It's a lot of people. That's 2 of every 10 people in Brandon are new to our country, not just to our city, but are new to our country. So immigration, foreigners. Our church, as this faith community, we've sponsored a number of refugee families. We've done it for decades ago. We did a few times. We did a couple of families. And now again, we've invested a lot of time and effort with refugee families coming over from Syria, from Eritrea. And so these kind of, this idea of what is a foreigner, what is a newcomer, what is a refugee, stuck in my head. And I dug a little bit into the scriptures about that. Because it seems to me that the discussion around immigration, around refugees and that, often gets framed by journalists, by politicians, by others who create the frames that we look at. In communication, we often talk about framing, because framing is a way of directing the perspective that someone takes. Framing is the words that we choose to use. I'll give you an example. My job normally is I work with Youth for Christ, and one of the things that we're doing is we are building a couple of new apartment blocks. We're starting a ministry among youth coming out of addictions. So we're starting these two 15-plex apartment blocks. They're big, they're expensive. It's a lot of big checks being written, and Dawn is nervous about that. And money flowing through our books. But anyway, so we're starting to dig, and I'm working with building permits, so I'm sitting down with Brandon Area Planning, and any of you who have been in construction in Brandon know that that is a complicated relationship. And so I years ago, my family built a fourplex in Brandon, and we had a tight time schedule because you're working with contractors and stuff, and I didn't have the permits yet, but I told the guys to start digging anyway. And so I got this nasty call from the building inspector because somebody had noticed that we were digging. And what are you doing? You don't have a building permit and all this. And he was quite upset. And I said, what? We're just landscaping. In his mind, it was foundation building. In my mind, I'm just digging dirt. It's just landscaping. On a political side right now, if you're watching in the news or listening, there's a scandal going on in Canada, SNC-Lavalin, and the government's dealing with that and so forth. And if you're a government supporter, you would view that as saving jobs. If you're not a government supporter, you would phrase it as saving his job, as in our prime minister's. And that's an example of framing. One person frames it one way, another person frames it a different way. So in these days, with journalists and politicians trying to frame our discussions, around immigration and around refugees. One will say we're being invaded by criminals and terrorists. Somebody else will say it is about desperate children who are starving, trying to find a new home. Those are just different words and different frames that really, what happens is the framing allows us to create stories. And when we latch on, once we've created this framework, then we create a story behind it. And once we create a story, then we start to attach emotions to it. So back to this immigration piece. So if you accept the framing that, if you accept and you build your framing around the idea that, we are being invaded by criminals and terrorists, then and the emotional response that you attach to that story would be probably one of fear. Now, if your framing was such that you thought of it as desperate, starving children, you would probably attach emotions of compassion to that. And your actions coming out of that would be very different. The actions that you will do coming out of fear is one thing. Actions coming out of compassion would be very different. So what I'd like to do this morning is I'd like to start to build a bit of a framework around the idea of scriptures. So what is scripture? I want to dig in a little bit into the scriptures and say, what does the Bible actually say about immigration and refugees? And start to build a bit of a framework on that and see where that can take us. See where that can take us this morning. About 1,400 years before Jesus was born, so we're about 3,400 years ago, standing in a desert of Paran, Moses was standing there. He had just come down from the mountain. He had just met God face to face, and he's talking to the people. And the people are about his, this is the people of Israel. These are his people, his relatives, and so on. And he's leading them, and he says, and he is bringing to them instructions. Now, these people have never been a nation. They've been foreigners in the land of Egypt. They're slaves and so forth for centuries. And now, for a couple of generations, they've been walking around the desert as basically a massive, massive Bedouin tribe moving around in the desert. And they're about to come into and conquer a land that they're going to settle. So this is God giving them rules to say, when you're settled, this is how you're going to organize your society. God is setting up a structure for them to say, this is how you're going to behave when you get there. So Moses is standing up. And in Leviticus 19, let's see where we're at here. Where's my framing? There we go. In Leviticus 19, 33 and 34, God says this. When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as a native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. For you are strangers in Egypt, in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Let's pause on that for a moment. The people hearing these words from God were people who could remember what it was like to be mistreated as a foreigner. When they lived in Egypt, they had been there for hundreds of years. They had started as a family of, whatever, a couple dozen people. And they had expanded into hundreds of thousands of people in their time in Egypt. And they remembered what it was like to be a people who were oppressed, who were treated unjustly, who were enslaved. They knew what it was like to be treated badly as a foreigner. A foreigner in a land where they had lived there, they were native born to Egypt, but they were always treated as foreigners to the land. And now they're coming into a land of their own, and God is telling them, remember how you were treated, do the opposite. Instead of seeking revenge, and now I'm the one in control and I will treat others as the one in power and control. No, God is saying you must act differently in my land when I bring you into the land. Treat that you shall love him as yourself. Six 600 years later, Jeremiah is a prophet. Prophets are basically, God sends them out, and they are his mouthpiece to the people. So Jeremiah the prophet is standing in the gateway of the temple. The temple at the time is people are active. They bring their sacrifices there. They come to worship Yahweh. And he comes, Jeremiah, the people are coming to worship, but they do their bit, they do their stuff before God, and then they go off and they live totally differently. So standing in front of the temple with all the people coming, this is what Jeremiah says to them. You must change the way that you are living and do what is right. You must treat one another fairly. Stop oppressing foreigners who live in your land, children who have lost their fathers, and women who have lost their husbands. Stop killing innocent people in the land. Stop paying allegiance to other gods. That will only bring about your ruin. If you stop doing these things, I will allow you to continue in the land, to live in this land, which I gave to your ancestors as a lasting possession. If you want to keep the land that God's given you, if you want to stay here, and you don't want to face the consequences, this is what you do. You stop oppressing the vulnerable. You stop being loyal to other gods. You seek justice, you act mercifully, and you follow the true God. It's kind of like what Paul was talking a little bit last week when he was talking about Micah 6:8. God's pretty simple. His framing gets pretty simple. Seek justice, act mercifully. So how does this work out in really practical ways? When you build this frame, how does this work out in practical ways? I want to see the scripture gives us, I'm going to pull three immigration examples from scripture. Abraham leaves his country in Iraq, and he heads down into Jordan area, into Israel. And he wanders around for a number of years with him and his family. He builds up some flocks. He's got his nephews with him. They're kind of expanding. They have children. They have hired hands. They have all of this, sheep and goats. And then the weather goes bad a couple of years, and you start to get droughts, and all of a sudden there's not enough food. So what does he do? Well, he packs everybody up, and they head down to Egypt. And they head down to Egypt because basically there's famine where they were, and they go to where they have a chance to live, because people go where they have a chance to live. If it's bad where you are now and you have to live, you have to care for your family, you have to do this, you go somewhere else. So he went to Egypt. And he does that for a period of time. And then when the famine is over and the land is producing again, then he returns back and he starts wandering back around in Canaan. It's a little bit in modern context, that would be equivalent to a lot of what happens with Mexicans, people coming up from Mexico and other countries who would come up as migrant workers. They come up to Canada for a period of time, they do their employment, they do their work, and they send money home. I mean, their family stays because they want to be. So their family stays in Mexico, and they travel up and come through. In fact, in the U.S., before, in the southern border, before, like in, you know, early 60s, mid-60s, before there was really a hard border, what would happen is people would simply go across the border north, they would get a job, they would provide for their family, and then they would go and live. But their family never moved. Like, the family stayed in Mexico, and they just kind of came into the U.S., worked for a while, earned some money, went back to Mexico, and it was very fluid back and forth. Because they didn't want to stay in the U.S., they wanted to stay in their home country, around their relatives and their community, where everybody spoke the same language, and it was comfortable in Mexico. But after the border became a lot harder, and it wasn't as easy to cross back and forth, then people stayed in the U.S. because that's where the jobs were. So then they were in there illegally, and they'd rather be in Mexico, but you can't because the way the borders went. So it's the same kind of idea here with Abraham. He travels to Egypt, stays there for a time, and then goes back home. Let's skip over to Jesus, because Jesus was also a refugee. In Matthew 2, we see the story of Jesus. He's born. He's to Mary and Joseph. They're living in the town, Bethany, and in Bethlehem. wise men come and see them in the house, and things are going okay. And then Herod finds out here's this prophecy about a new ruler, and so the king feels threatened. So the political leadership now feels threatened that there is somebody there who is going to take their throne, and all of a sudden he gets angry and he's going to go kill everybody. So God talks to Mary and Joseph and says, you need to flee, you need to become a political refugee in Egypt. And so they head through the desert of Paran again. They go down through the desert, they go back to Egypt, and they live there for a number of years as political refugees. Basically, they'd rather be in Israel, they'd rather be among their people, but until the politics change, until the leadership has changed in Israel, it's not safe. And so they live as refugees in Egypt. And we don't know much about that time at all. We just know that after a while, Herod dies, the leadership changes, and Jesus goes back. Mary and Joseph bring their family back. And we've experienced that here in modern times, in our situation here in Canada. Not that long ago, we had a number of Americans sneaking across the border coming north during the Vietnam War because they were trying to dodge conscription. They didn't want to go to war. They didn't like what their leadership was doing. So they became political refugees in Canada. Some of them chose to stay and to try and make a life here in Canada. Others waited till the climate changed and then they went back to the U.S. But they were up here for a while as political refugees. The third example I want to highlight from Scripture is Ruth. There's two women who live in Jordan, and their husbands die. And at the time, there's no social safety net for them. They don't own land. They don't have a means of income, and their husbands are dead. So they come back, or not come back. The one woman was Jewish. She's Israelite. And she brings her foreign daughter-in-law with her. And they come back to Israel, and they live there for a time. Now, they're poor. Ruth is a foreigner, so she is a woman. She is poor, and she's a foreigner, so she's got all these strokes against her. But what she does is, through her character, through some hard work, she takes on some jobs that Israelites don't want to do. She takes on a job scavenging after the harvesters, doing the work that Israelites don't want to do. And over time, her character, her hard work, and a little bit of well-placed flirting gets her a marriage to a wealthy, older Israelite guy. And she finds a path into the family. Which is a lot like what we have in some ways. Everybody group has their sort of ceremonies and they have their ways that you can go from being a foreigner to being part of the family. We do that here in citizen, and when we call it, we do it with citizenship. You can go through a process of citizenship and become a Canadian, be part of the family. When Europeans first came over, the indigenous people who welcomed them into the land had their own ceremonies. They had these ceremonies that said, because they were not unused to foreigners coming, there would be other people from other tribes, there'd be connections between people. So they had ways of making what they called making treaties. So they had the ceremony, and the ceremonies were a little different, but depending on the tribe, but you would have this ceremony, and you'd have this European foreigner, and you'd have and the indigenous people, and you'd meet together, and you would make a covenant together. And from an indigenous perspective, when you're making this, you go through the ceremony, you do a covenant together, what their goal is to become family. It's to become a relative, sibling or cousin or something. So this is my European cousin. And you share the land. You now share the resources. So they had this ceremony and this path to becoming family. Just like Ruth had. And the Jews had this idea that you could be, if you wanted to, you could be an immigrant into a new land. And you could go through this ceremony where you gave up your old allegiances. You took on a new allegiances. You gave up your old sort of relations. And you became part of this new family. And that was the process. Okay, so we have some biblical commands and directions on how to treat foreigners. You love them as you love yourself. In your relationships, we're supposed to seek justice and act mercifully. We had a couple of examples. We've had some good ones like Abraham and Ruth. We've had some bad ones like we talked about the Israelites in Egypt and slavery. But those worlds are a little different than the New Testament. In the New Testament, we have a place where, we have a situation where people are not in power. They don't rule the land. In the Old Testament, it was a lot more about ruling, because they were talking to a people who for the most, for most of the Old Testament, or the time there, the people ruled the land. They could exercise the laws. They could be the ones who systematically, a king could act justly, and it would spread throughout the land. They would force, they could impose justice into the land. But now they can't. The New Testament, the Bible is written, and they're speaking to people who are not empowered. This is a lot more like in our scenario, where you have multiple faiths, you have multiple ethnic groups together, you have a lot more of this sort of pluralistic thing going along, and you are not in complete power. None of us are in this position where we have this complete power. So what does the New Testament say to that? Well, in the New Testament, they talk about hospitality. As Christians, as those who are following Christ, we practice hospitality. This is for me, this was a really revolutionary way of looking at the word hospitality that Paul uses in Romans, for example, means the love of strangers. Okay, so when I've always looked at and I've read those hospitality things, passages, and most often hospitality, I think of in terms of how I treat people I know, my neighbors, you guys, whatever, my family, people I get to work with. I think of hospitality and being like, you know, a good host. I know how to make coffee or how to serve and greet people at the door and shake their hands and look them in the eye and all of that kind of stuff, right? That's hospitality. But the word means love of strangers. So let me look at the passage here, for example, in Romans 12:12. Rejoice in hope, endure in suffering, persist in prayer, contribute to the needs of the saint, pursue the love of strangers. Contribute to the needs of the saints, pursue the love of strangers. That feels a little different than the way I have, the way I've looked at hospitality. The passage refers to the provision of material needs. As one commentator wrote, Christian hospitality focuses on taking care of strangers and guests. Our homes, our hearts, and our pockets must be open to serve them. One of the things I found interesting is that often discussions about immigration and refugees fall around economics. I have sat into many conversations with my family many of the arguments about whether to accept people coming into Canada or not is about economics. Can we afford them? Come on, people who come here, all they do is they just live on welfare, and if they live on welfare, then it's coming out of my tax dollars, and my tax dollars are paying for. Yeah, I hear those conversations. But economics is a driver. People leave their homes and their families for economic reasons. Paul tells us in Timothy, and this is not bad, Paul tells us in Timothy where if you don't take care of your family, you're worse than an unbeliever, which in his context is pretty bad. You got to take care of your family. So why do people leave? Why do you leave Nicaragua? You leave it because there's no food there. You leave it because you can't have a job. You can't care for your family. So you make this big long trek up north because you hope there's a job somewhere. Because you understand that you got to care for your family. So they come looking for jobs. That's why Abraham went to Egypt. He went there looking for a job. That's why Ruth came to Israel. She's looking to care for her family. All right? So it's not a wrong at all. So economics is often in this question of how do we frame this view of immigration and refugees? Can we afford that? Can they come? Can our economy handle it? Can we economically sustain? I don't know. But according to Romans, Christian hospitality focuses on taking care of strangers and guests. Our homes, our hearts, and our pocketbooks must be open to serve them. Somebody told me this, just on this piece. Somebody had said, look, I pay my taxes. I pay my taxes, and that's kind of how I care for immigration and refugees. Because the government does it, right? They come here, people come here, they get jobs, or they don't get jobs. So if they have to find supports and whatever else, so the government does that, and that's my tax dollar. So that's my way of caring. And I'm like, well, okay. I pay a lot of taxes too. I get that. But if you're going to do that, if that's the rationale, then you also got to be really, really politically active. Because you think about it for a minute. If we're going to trust our politicians to take our money and to be the ones who act to seek justice and act mercifully on our behalf, then we better make sure that they're seeking justice and acting mercifully, right? Because they're taking my money, and this, and it's my excuse now that I'm not giving. I'm not the one doing the acts of mercy and so forth, because I'm paying the government to do it on my behalf through my taxes. We better make sure they do it, right? So that changes our activities. So it kind of becomes one of those things. In my family, it's a bit of an interesting discussion, because it's actually a discussion killer, really. when the tax thing comes up and I say, so how are you actively? And then it kills the discussion. So, but back to this. I don't want to sound like, because it, maybe this sounds like I'm building this framework that's really hyper compassionate, and maybe you got a lot of yabbits going in your head, which is great. Like, that's all part of this framing, is we have to build a frame that's going to work and it's going to be strong enough to withstand some of the yabbits and questions that come into our heads. And so I don't want to create this idea that it's really simple and really straightforward, because building this biblical framework isn't like that. For example, when we talk about compassionate and that, so we get people who come to the country illegally, and we have these nice pictures of RCMP officers helping people illegally cross the border, carry their stuff for them. It's a bit weird. And we feel compassion. We go, oh, they're fleeing economic crisis, or they're fleeing, they're being persecuted in their home country. But everything comes with a cost. And so the people that we don't see are the people who live in refugee camps, who are going through a legal process to come into Canada. And because we're spending resources, time, and energy on people who are illegally crossing, we're not bringing people who are trying to legally come. So who are we acting justly towards? Right? It's not straightforward. Our compassion can't drive us to act unjustly towards somebody. Our compassion for one person can't make us be unjust to somebody else. So what I'm saying is, this isn't straightforward and easy. There's a lot of valid sides to this discussion. Move to this. Hebrews 12, this is another passage with that hospitality. Do not neglect the love of strangers, because through it, some have entertained angels without knowing it. I love that image, right? We don't know who wrote Hebrews. Some people think Paul, some people somebody else. But the scriptures tell us this: do not neglect the love of strangers, because through it, some have entertained angels without knowing it. Do not neglect the love of new immigrants, of refugees, of others who are strange to us, because through it, some have entertained angels without knowing it. So we're creating this framework to look forward. The scriptures tell us to seek justice. The scriptures tell us to act with mercy. The scriptures tell us to love the strangers as we love ourselves. Now maybe this is only a three-pointed frame, like, right? Maybe it's just, oops, how do we do that? I'm making a four. No, it's like this. Okay, so maybe it's only like this. Maybe that's the only framework that the scriptures are giving us. But maybe there's a fourth. Like, maybe it's a full, or maybe it's even got five sides. I don't know, but I do know that these three exist. I do know that the scriptures are clear on these three parts to the framing. If we're going to create a story about how we feel and what it means for and how we act towards new immigrants or towards refugees, then I know that these have to be part of it. So what does it mean to love a refugee as I love myself? What actions would I do that would demonstrate, if you were watching my life, what actions could I do that would demonstrate to you that I am acting mercifully towards a stranger, a new immigrant, refugee? What would that look like? How should I address others around me who have opinions and voice them that are very different than this framing? That's one interesting piece about seeking justice, is that seeking justice isn't passive. If we accept this framing as biblical, then we get a bit pushed into a bit of a corner, because we can't then be passive about it, because seeking justice is an active piece. So then if we're in conversations, we know other people, where other people around us who start to have comments and start to drive a conversation or try to create a framework that is unmerciful, that is unjust, then justice drives us to intervene. We can no longer be passive if seeking justice is part of our framework. We can't just allow it to happen. We need to be active. That's me. I threw that into there because I think what is at the heart of God's frame is that He loves us, and He wants us to love others the same way He loves us. And so when we think about immigration, we think about refugees, we think we have to put ourselves into that frame. That's what God says in Leviticus when He talks to the Israelites. He says, you were in Egypt. You get this. You know what it is to be mistreated as an immigrant or as a refugee. You know what it's like. So don't do that. Be different. So I think we have to put ourselves in that frame, and it makes it maybe a little bit easier to say, well, if I'm like this, this is how I want to be treated, I'm going to have to treat others that way. If I'm the one who's starving, or I'm the one who's running away from oppression, how do I want to be treated? Treat others like that. Love the foreigner as we love ourselves. We'll have time. Like I said, this is not a complete end of thing. This is more of a starting into a discussion. There's a lot of aspects to biblically framing this whole discussion. So if you have other questions and stuff like that, there will be time at the end. You can throw them out. Maybe there is. But I also encourage, if you have, you know, dig into scriptures at home, whatever. Let the Spirit guide you, lead you into some really interesting sort of places about how we treat each other and how we should look at this issue. Thanks.